Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, there's something I think awe-inspiring about standing inside a barn, the size of a barn, the workmanship that's involved, the history. You think about the history and making it a special building. And we're taking a closer look at barns this morning, and our guest is William Tischler, an emeritus professor of landscape architecture at UW-Madison. He's an award-winning author, served as chair of the Wisconsin Historic Preservation Board, and developed the master plan for Old World Wisconsin. And we'll be talking to the director of Old World Wisconsin at around 11:45 today, as a matter of fact. It's the state's outdoor museum of rural life. But first, it's barns. Is there a special barn or barns you want to tell us about? You have questions about different styles of barns? Want to hear from you. You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Bill Tischler, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thank you very much, Larry.
You know, I grew up on a farm, and so we had a what I thought was a pretty big barn. It was about 40 by 80 somewhere in there. So I spent a lot of time in that barn, and I spent a lot of time in later, when I was a teenager, for a couple of years, I worked with a farm family and milked cows in a round barn. So I've had some experience. I'm wondering how you got involved with barns.
Well, my father was a carpenter, and many of my relatives back home in Door County are builders. I grew up in Bailey's Harbor, and it still had a number of barns right in the community. And as a kid, we had a great time playing in them and sometimes helping the farmer out with milking or feeding their cattle.
I was just in Bailey's Harbor area a week or so ago, and I love to drive around, and you still see some of those barns. But there's a few missing, and we can talk about that later. But let's get into the your book is really fascinating, really interesting read about the history of barns. First, tell us about the European roots of Wisconsin barns.
Sure. Well, barns date back to many parts of the world, certainly in Central Europe. And one early version of a barn was a house barn, whereby its occupants and cattle lived under the same roof. That way, the cattle gave off heat to warm the place, and they were a bit easier to feed and to keep an eye on. Gradually, barns evolved into timber frame structures when more wood became available, and many types of barns evolved with that construction system.
When the barn building came to America, those designs there were certainly taken and borrowed from the European designs. But how were they altered to fit into what we had here in America?
Yes, there definitely was a European origin to their patterns, and of course, when immigrants came to America, they had a lot more land, and they didn't need to build a house barn, which would conserve space. They could build a farmstead, which had a series of structures for the horses, cows, sheep, and so on. And they used a construction system that developed over a long period of time in Europe, and it involved using heavy timbers, which were usually cut in the farmer's woodlot and then brought to the construction site and then shaped so as to fit into the skeleton members of the barn, the structural system.
And they used oak a lot, if I'm not mistaken.
Oak, because of its strength, was a favored material. Yes, yes, it was.
And I thought it was interesting that in Europe, they didn't have the trees and the forest anymore, whereas we had all kinds of it.
Exactly, that's right. So we could get the huge beams that were necessary in the structural system of the barn. Sometimes they grew right on the farmer's woodlot. And at other times, they were brought in often over the ice during the wintertime.
How important, I think they were really important, but how important were barns to farmers?
Oh, they were the icon, the essential item of their occupation. Farms were big, barns were big, and they served a number of purposes, including sheltering cattle and storing crops and processing crops. Later, somewhat storing machinery, but they were absolutely essential. They were the icon of the farmstead.
Yeah. And the way they were built, there were a lot. I know the early barns in Europe were kind of one-story affairs often, but we went with two-story barns at least here. Talk about why and so forth.
Sure. The way that happened was the very early barns were built flat on the ground without an underlying stone foundation. And that was because of the wheat-growing industry. Later, when more immigrants came from Central Europe and knew about processing different crops and dairying, they would jack these old barns up and build a stone foundation underneath. And that was where the cattle were kept.
So the cows could walk right out of the out onto the ground and didn't have to go upstairs or down.
Right, right. When they would build the second story on a barn, usually had an earthen ramp, and the cattle could and the machinery could go right up from ground level into the second story of the barn.
And that's where the hay and so forth was typically went.
Yes, yes, that's correct.
Bill Tischler, our guest, William Tischler, his wonderful book is titled Building Wisconsin Barns. Great to have him with us today. Archway Publishing did the book. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Eugene and Viola, thank you for...
Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
My mother and father, we moved here in 1954 when a lot of those old barns were still being used for milking cows. And there's a lot of them in this area. And a few of them have been torn down for barn work, but a lot of people are keeping their barns and putting steel roofs on them.
Interesting. A comment on that, Bill?
Yes, a steel roof will last much, much longer than wood shingles. In the old days, they made shingles by hand from white cedar, which was abundant in parts of Wisconsin. And they will deteriorate, though, over time, especially if the barn is built on a northwest, on an east-west axis. That way, part of the barn roof doesn't get sunshine to dry things out, and the other side of the roof facing north could stay moist and moss would develop and the shingles would deteriorate quickly.
Yeah, that north-south was the preferred way for many. I mean, if you could do it, you did it north and south, didn't you, Bill?
Actually, east-west.
East-west?
Right. And if there was a hill on the grounds, on the acreage, sometimes it was built into the hillside, so that you could have access easily to the second story and then the basement level down below.
Deb in Menominee Falls has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I'm just curious if the guest could shed any light on many trips that I've taken in and around Iowa. I noticed early on that along the top ridge of the barn, on the barn roof, they often, many of them, have like a little mini barn of sorts. Instead of like a cupola or something, like what we have a lot on our barns in Wisconsin. And I'm just wondering how that came to be or, you know, if the guest knows anything about the history of that.
So a little mini barn on top of the barn.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, that may have been to add more space and possibly for ventilation. Larry, I was wrong about the barn orientation. You were right. It's a north-south orientation was preferred so that both sides of the roof would get an equal amount of light and ventilation.
That's what I thought from your book. It wasn't from any knowledge, prior knowledge I had, for sure. And those shingles, by the way, didn't they often, they would soak them in water so they wouldn't split when you when they were nailed on?
Yes. What was done was when they made them by hand, they would take a block of wood and then use a tool called a fro, which had a sharp metal blade and a short wood handle, and knock it into the block of wood, and off would come a shingle. Then if they had a schnitzel bunk or a device for shaving them down, they would taper one side a bit.
Taper it a little bit. Yeah, interesting. And Deb, thanks again. Appreciate it. Dennis in Two Rivers, we'll go to you. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Larry. Yeah, when I was 4 years old to 6 years old, we lived on a farm, and just thinking about when like I heard before also that cattle used to live on the first floor and people used to live on the second floor, it seemed to be kind of wouldn't be so desirable as far as odors. So it was nice to have a barn further away, but then as a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, 6-year-old, it seemed like a long walk, but a red barn was easier to find in stormy weather. The problem was we had a white house, and in winter that could be difficult for a 4-, 5-, and 6-year-old to find.
There you go. Maybe talk about the color. We're kind of skipping ahead a little bit here, but that's all right. We can go back and talk some more about the construction. But that red barn, what an iconic thing. And there's lots of reasons, I think, why red turned out to be a preferred color, although yellow has also played a role, as I noted in your book.
Yeah, red was used because it was cheap. It was made with iron oxide and turpentine. And Frank Lloyd Wright even said that there ought to be a state law requiring all barns in Wisconsin to be red in color.
Yeah, they really stand out. I mean, from a visual art sort of point of view, isn't it wonderful in the landscape to see those red barns?
Yes, they contrast nicely with the green area around them or during the wintertime with the snow fields.
Phil in Mount Horeb has a question about foundations, I think. Phil, go ahead.
Hi. So we have a 30-by-60 bank barn, which is the barn that your guests can explain in better detail than I can. But we've replaced the roof with a metal green roof. It's a red bank barn. And we have a deterioration of the limestone foundation of the barn in the northwest corner of the barn, which probably takes most of the rain and weather beating. My question is, we consulted with someone about what to do in order to shore up this foundation. And he suggested that we, first of all, do no harm. Second, he said, don't use a Portland cement.
Right.
Use a Type S mortar that is designed to crumble. The sacrificial but beneficial mortar, he said, is a Type S. I just wanted to get your guests' feedback, comment on that.
Yes. In restoring an old building that has used lime mortar, not Portland cement, it's important to continue using lime mortar, which consists of lime mixed with sand and water. Portland cement will be much harder, and it will crack some of the joints that have been made with the old type of mortar. So that's not a good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had some calls when we've talked about home repair, and people have asked that question about some of their older homes, and the advice given on those shows was exactly the same as what you just gave, Bill. Phil, pay attention to them, to that piece of advice for sure. Callers, you can join in too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us to ideas@WPR.org. Talking with William Tischler. Bill's an emeritus professor of landscape architecture at UW-Madison. He's a great writer, and his latest book is called Building Wisconsin Barns. Trina LaSousa is our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at Wisconsin barns on the show today with Bill Tischler, William Tischler's book titled Building Wisconsin's Barns. Join in, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@WPR.org. So the just go back, before we go back to the phones, just to talk a bit more about framing, I thought it was so interesting to read about how these barns were framed, and you had a lot of times you had somebody in charge, but then there were a lot of local farmers or local people that would come over and help with it.
Yes, often friends and neighbors would pitch in, because building a barn was kind of a massive project and it could require a lot of workers. And they would work together, and their wives would make a big dinner. And at the end of the day, they would sit at a table made of wood planks on sawhorses, and the ladies would serve pie and lemonade and other tasty foods.
Yeah, it was really something. And I got a kick out of, you know, our earlier caller mentioned a barn on top of a barn, a little barn on top of the big barn, but crowning the barn, talk about that. That was kind of fun, too.
That's an interesting age-old ceremony. When the framework was put up and the rafters were erected, the master barn builder would usually go up and nail to the very top of the roof either a coniferous tree, which is said would attract storks, which was a good thing in the old country, or sometimes it was a wreath made out of woven straw or branches with a bottle of brandy in the middle, which would be open at the end of the day.
And even back then, brandy was a popular drink in Wisconsin. That's for sure. Oh, boy. Jeff in Superior, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. My great-grandmother immigrated from Sweden and worked for Martin Pattison here in Superior. And after a few years of doing that, she got married, and they moved out to a farm in Hawthorne where they built their barn. Huge, massive, over 100 feet long and, 70 feet wide or something like that. But the orientation was in three sections on the first, on the ground level. You had the horses on the north end. In the middle was the equipment. And on the south end was the cows closer to the house, you know. And the doors went from side to side, not along the long part of the barn. And when I grew up in the 60s, my grandpa would have me whitewash the walls in the barn where the cows used to be. And I was always wondering, why didn't they just paint it white? What was the purpose? Was it a sanitary reason? And what was the whitewash made of? That's what I always wondered.
Lime, I think. But go ahead, Bill.
Sure. The whitewash was made with lime, and sometimes horsehair was mixed in with it for adhesion. And white, of course, is a good color for sanitation purposes.
Yeah, it's. I can remember actually taking part in one of that on one of the barns farms that we lived on. You were kind of white yourself by the time you were finished with it. That's for sure. Thanks for that question, Daniel in Hazelhurst. Your turn. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is more of a comment than a question, but my family, last name was Single, came from England to what was, I believe, then Big Bull Falls in 1849. And my great-grandfather, four brothers and one sister, all stayed in the area for their entire lives. And my great-uncle Jim built a barn in the 1850s which as a kid, we no longer owned the farm, but my dad kept in touch with the owners, and we would go out there and look at the massive structure. And anyway, there was a storm in the early 1980s that took the barn down. And it was about the same time that my parents were rebuilding their house. And the light bulb went on, and my folks went out there and talked to the people, asked if they could, recover the beams. And now it's my folks' house in Hazelhurst has these incredible beams. It's all exposed that line the ceiling and cross it in the living room and the dining room. And there's all these pegs that I guess, you know, that's how you fit them together, these big, massive wooden pegs, and it looks fantastic. And I was just wondering, maybe is this something that occurs frequently, and
yeah,
anyway, it's really great sense of pride when you look up at the ceiling and you see something that's 150 or so years old.
Yeah, absolutely, Bill. What do you think?
Well, most of the old barns had a very strong structural system, and that consisted of vents which ran transversely across the barn and supported other horizontal members on which the rafters were placed. But the way they were attached was with pins, and a tapered end was at the end of the beam, and then the member it was to be inserted in was hollowed out with by drilling holes and then taking a mortising chisel and squaring off the corners. The mortising chisel was at 45-degree angles. Then a pin, usually of oak, was inserted and driven through the holes in both members, and that was much better than nails. Nails could crack the wood. They could rust. They weren't as strong as the old mortise and tenon system.
That's really interesting. Daniel, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, on those timbers, you describe, you know, how they used to, back in the day, how they used to kind of, chip them and, you know, work them into shape. And one process, the wood itself kind of looked like fish scales. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, the process ending up looking like fish scales was usually done with not a broad axe, but the other type of an adze. Most barns, though, were made from a tree, and the tree was anchored onto two horizontal timbers beneath. And then a workman would come along, or two workmen, and snap a chalk line across the top. And that was the line to which the hewing occurred. Then somebody with a double-bitted axe usually would score the log about every 16 inches. And then the final treatment was when a skilled axeman would come with a broad axe, which had a curved handle so he wouldn't hurt his knuckles, and flake off the intermediate chips. And I've seen some beams that look so smooth, you could have sworn they were sawn in a sawmill. But actually, they were made by hand with mortise and tenon joints and someone with a broad axe.
You know, I loved all of the photos, the old photos and some paintings, but mostly photos in the bar in your book. And that you have one really good example of that process, that the finished product and what it looked like. And it does appear to look a bit like fish scales.
Yes, those were removed with an adze, which was an instrument with a curved handle. And the work person would stand on the log with an axe and flake off enough sections to make it a reasonably flat surface.
Yeah, really cool. And the adze, I always loved that name. And I often wondered, was it adze or was it adze? A-D-Z-E is how it's spelled, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right, A-D-Z.
Yeah.
Or A-D-Z-E.
Yeah, one or the other. It could be either. Linda in Sheboygan, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
I worked at a barn outside of Plymouth. It was turned into a tea room and quilt sales room. It was an absolutely brilliant business. It was a barn transformed into what is the brand name of the business was Country Crafts, and people from all over brought quilts for sale. And also I was going to mention there was a book called The Barn by Louis Bromfield in the 40s. But that's about all I have to say.
Well, thanks a lot. You bring up a lot. Do you know that book, by the way, Bill?
Yes, I do. That is a good book.
And just talking about different uses, I mean, so many barns went down, but it's good to know that some barns, rather than going down, are being repurposed.
Yes. Yes. Sometimes there are examples of barns that have been recycled. For example, one good example is my grandfather's barn in Egg Harbor, which is now the Birch Creek Music Academy. It's part of a concert hall. There's an art gallery in Door County, Edgewood Galleries, that was part of a barn. And, of course, there are some good examples of barns at Old World, Wisconsin, one of my favorites, in fact.
Yeah, and we'll be talking about Old World, Wisconsin in 10 or 12 minutes here on the show, so I'm kind of looking forward to that as well, and I know you have a big history with that. Linda, thanks. Appreciate the call. John in Appleton, we'll give you a chance. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for taking my call. Both my grandfathers came here from Norway, and my mother's brother, my favorite uncle, had a farm in the Arlington Prairie, very rich farmland, as you probably know. And he had a round barn. And the old joke, of course, was, how do you drive a Norwegian farmer crazy? And that is, tell him to go stand in the corner of the round barn. So my question for Bill is, what percentage or how many of the round barns are left?
And why were they built? Talk about the sort of the background on the reasoning of it, too.
Sure. There are a few hundred left, but not many, and they're sort of scattered around the state. But it was said that the round barns could resist the pressure from a strong wind better, and it actually utilized more less material in its siding. And also, many round barns had the silo right in the center, and the stanchions for the cows were arranged so that the cows faced the center where they could be fed easily from the silage in the silo in the middle.
Yeah, and I had a lot of experience, a couple of years experience milking cows out of a round barn back when I was a teenager. And it was kind of a cool thing. That barn no longer exists because it was the Rodefeld barn, and that is now the Dane County landfill.
Mm.
Which I was a little sad about that for sure. But the was there a particular group of people that were most interested in round barns? I don't remember now from the reading. Was it, you know, were the Norwegians the ones that brought the round barns, or what was the deal?
Well, most of them were built by Native Americans because the round barn came on the scene later, and it was advertised by the University Extension Service, its advantages and so on. So it caught on a little later in time, after the regular rectangular-shaped barns.
And I believe in your book, you talk about the Unitarian Church in Mequon that actually built its church in that fashion.
Yes, that was an octagonal shape. And they built it that way because there were a number, actually about a dozen, about in that Washington County, East Central Wisconsin area. Most of them were built by one barn builder. and they wanted to reflect the sense of place of the area for the church. So they came up with the idea of making it octagonal in shape. It's an interesting structure and an attractive structure as well.
And you have a photo of it in your barn, in your book.
Right.
Yeah. Is it still being used in that fashion?
As far as I know, Larry, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's that's pretty darn cool. Well, Brenda in Monroe, your turn. Hi, Brenda.
Hi there. I grew up on a dairy in western Dane County with a Gambrel Bank barn, and we had a yellow barn. You made a comment earlier about how yellow barns were fairly common, and that caught me off guard because we were the only yellow barn in the area. Everything else was red or white. So I was wondering if you could expand on the yellow aspect of it, please.
Sure. Some railroad companies utilized yellow for painting their structures, and that caught on for some barns, especially if they were close to a particular railroad line. But that's how yellow came about.
So they got the paint from the railroads, or
sure, it would have been cheaper, you know, and easily obtained because it was right nearby.
Oh, for sure. So the railroads, Brenda, were kind of responsible in a way for the yellow barns that we still see a few of them around the state of Wisconsin. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, framing, you know, as I think about the framing and so forth, and as you look around, you know, you'll see a particular type of barn maybe in Door County, and you might see another type of barn elsewhere. What were the main styles of barns?
Well, the earliest barns had gable roofs, in other words, an inverted V. But around the time of, World War I, the gambrel roof was developed, and that had that extra angle in each side of the roof. And that was done so more hay could be stored inside. And later, though, they developed curved beams. The Forest Products Laboratory did a lot of work on that. Curved beams, and those barns were called Gothic style. But the roof is curved on each side.
And I remember reading the style changed sometimes according to circumstances. That plank framing, for example, that became popular, when was it, around 1910 or 15, somewhere in there in the state, mostly because of not as much timber as there was before, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's right. Those gambrel roof barns were frequently made, the framework was made by 2x12 planks nailed or bolted together. They didn't have the heavy timbers anymore, and the planks fastened together lended themselves to the structural system of the gambrel roof.
Interesting. And you know, here in Wisconsin, I'm thinking about our barn that we had. It was a very big barn, but it was the milk house got attached later. But milk houses, I know you talk about milk houses, you talk about tobacco sheds, and that brought back a lot of memories because living in Cottage Grove, you know, Stoughton area, where tobacco was growing. I spent a lot of time in the rafters of tobacco sheds, having the tobacco laths handed up to me with 5 or 6 tobacco plants on it, and I placed them there for drying.
Yeah, they were a somewhat unique structure in the tobacco growing areas. They were one story and with a gable roof usually, and the sides of the barn were made so that every other siding board could be opened for ventilation to help dry the tobacco crop inside.
Yeah, I remember they'd open those side doors up and let that air in, but it was dangerous work, I can tell you that. It was a job for a young man. It was not a job for me at my current age, for sure.
Well, barn building was a kind of a dangerous occupation. And I had one very elderly barn builder tell me that what he was proud of over his many years of building barns was that he'd never lost a man, as he put it. Because you could easily fall from the rafters, and, you know, that could be quite dangerous, if not fatal.
Yeah, and, actually, that's one of the kind of the interesting thing, or favorite things, maybe. Jill Nadeau thought it was her one of her favorite things in your book, was your account of talking with Martin Roth. Tell us about him.
Sure. Martin Roth was an interesting old-timer, and I interviewed him about 25 years ago, and the interview is in the book. And he took us around. I had a student who was from Abbotsford whose father was a mailman, and the mailman, of course, knew many of the people in that rural area, including Martin Roth. So I went with one of my students to meet Martin. He was a really interesting old guy, had a lot to say about his experiences. And we went around to look at some of the barns that he had built. So I have a photograph of him at the back of the book.
Yeah.
And that was that was a great time spent out in the field.
I bet it was. He said he built some that were 100 foot, so, or at least one that was 100 footer. Still up, too. How long will they? They last a long, long time if they had the right kind of shingling, didn't they? Or don't they?
Oh, yes, yes. They should last a long time. And when a metal roof was put on, that greatly increased the life of a barn.
So what's the future of traditional Wisconsin barns, do you think?
Well, they're falling by the wayside quickly. And because they're, in many ways, a problem for farmers who don't want to pay the taxes on them. They are in the way. They're too small for holding large machinery. So we're losing our distinctive barns. And unless some enterprising people can come along and find an adaptive use for them, like a restaurant or a gift shop or a concert hall or an art sales enterprise, we're going to lose most of them, and with them will go an important part of our rural heritage.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I hope we can keep as many as we can. Bill, this is a great book. I really enjoyed it. As I said, you're right. You're a great writer, but then also the, I don't know how many photos you've got in that book, but and pictures. But it's really helps bring the whole story alive. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us today. And I know you were chair of the Wisconsin Historic Preservation Review Board, and you developed the master plan for Old World Wisconsin.
That's right, with a group of very talented students. That was shortly after I joined the university faculty, back in the late 60s.
Well, coming up, we're going to be talking with Dan Fries, who is the site director for Old World Wisconsin. So if you have a chance to keep listening in, I hope you will, Bill.
I definitely will, yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us. William Tischler, T-I-S-H-L-E-R, Tischler, and his book is titled Building Wisconsin's Barns. Take a look at it. I think you're going to really enjoy it. It's published by Archway Publishing. And he's probably going to write another book at some point, and we'll have him back. Or maybe we'll have him back to talk about barns again. He sure knows a whole lot about our next topic, I think, as well, as we visit about Old World Wisconsin. There's lots going on there, and we'll find out about it next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.